I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. Remarks on our program today from River Houston, a recognized sex columnist and advocate for women health issues. This is part two of our series. Ms. Houston spoke at a conference on women issues at Arkansas State University. The topic was how women feel about their bodies.
How did I get to this place where I am such a sex goddess, and you too, and you're a sex goddess to me. I mean, everyone here, even, sorry, you, definitely. It's all about perception, but it was also having my butt kicked. I was in my last year of college, as I talked about being a fitness trainer, I was totally obsessed about my body. I mean, that was what it was about. I'd work out sometimes up to 8 hours a day. Not only would I teach aerobics or a calisthenics class or train people privately, give massage, and then I would do my own private workout. And I would do this every day. And 15 of those days, I only drank liquids. I was never satisfied. In the bedroom, I had the covers up to my neck. I could find things. I can remember sometimes lifting weights in the gym and just like maybe turning, and I always had, you know, this little goddess belly here. I'd look and I'd see me, but then it was like about this big, and I would see it and I'd throw the weights down. This is useless. Obsessed, completely obsessed. I was on a spiritual journey in other realms of my life as far as trying to change my perception and spiritually and things like that, but I had not connected it to the body stuff. I met a guy in my last year of college. A guy, you know, makes your heart go pitter-patter, girl, whatever species, who knows. The thing that you love, and the good part about it was that he loved me too, which is great, right? Because then you can cut the whole stalking part of the relationship. And out of nowhere, I had finally gotten to the place in my life where I didn't call it, I had no great sex education growing up, but at that time, there was nothing called abstinence. I just called it No More Losers. I grew up not feeling good about my body, not feeling good about myself in any way, shape, or form. And the way that I fixed it was through food, alcohol, and sex. And I had felt that I had gotten to a place where I'd kind of taken away a lot of at least the alcohol and the sex part. I didn't also feel responsible for men's sex drives. I didn't have to do that anymore. And I ended up in this place where I decided that I was not going to have sex until I was really certain. And I thought this person might be it, but I was going to be certain. And we were going to have at least 3 dates. No, I'm just kidding. We waited months, actually. And for some of you, that's like, that's nothing. I met this one guy, waited 7 years. I thought, I was like, that's insane, okay. Maybe not, no. So everyone has their virgin's rule. But anyway, and you can be a virgin as many times as you want. we ended up being, you know, just making out, no sex, no anything like that. And I'm like totally into him, he's totally into me. And out of nowhere, I'm about to graduate, he says to me that we should get tested. And I'm thinking, tested? I mean, tested, I just went to college 5 years. I've been tested. I mean, it had no relevance in my consciousness what tested meant. And I blew him off, and I'm writing a paper on training athletes for events, and I'm totally into my starving thing. And he calls, you know, it keeps you busy. You know, it keeps a nice distance. You think a podium keeps a distance? Let me tell you, starving yourself keeps a nice distance between you and everyone, because you are so hungry. Anyway. So they're there, you know. So anyway, he calls me up, and I guess I was in the eating phase of my month, because he said that he made an appointment to get tested, and if I called now, I could go. And I made the appointment, and I'm not going to go into the details, but basically we went and we got an HIV test. We went back for our test results, firmly in the belief that both of us were negative, and firmly, totally, completely shocked when my test came back positive. And the reason that I talk about that relationship ended that day, short term. He went his way, and I went my way. And the way that I went to the diner. I had not eaten fat in a decade. I had not had a fat item in a decade. I had not had butter. I mean, I look at butter and almost want to, I was so afraid of like a jar of mayonnaise. It's more frightening than a gun. And I went to the diner, and I ordered French toast syrup and butter. And it was so good. I was so good. I can't even begin to tell. I was like, ordered another. And In that year, I gained almost 80 pounds. I never noticed. It was like, you know how sometimes heavier people, when they lose weight, they still think they're fat. And I just still thought I was like size zero or whatever. And I just didn't buy anything. They all had no sizes. You know, I love those clothes, no size. One size fits all, great. And nice floral prints, you could just flow through the mirror. Oh, no, nah, looking good, you know. I used to be like the worst fitness trainer. I was like, I was so hardcore, I'd make you suffer. It was great, you wear all black and have half-naked men on the floor and make them cry. And in my classes, I mean, I would make people do like 1,000 crunches. And now, like, at the minute someone would complain, I'm, no, let's stretch, you know. My classes all changed, like all the models and actors all left. I was doing this in New York, and it was all just housewives. We'd chat, and it became, then I started just to teach yoga, forget about it. And then as I gained this weight, you know, I didn't really notice it. And then I was diagnosed with another life-threatening disease, bone marrow disease, and they told me that I have long to live. So I left New York City and I went to Pennsylvania, and I still didn't know that I had gained so much weight because I just refused to look at it until someone took a photograph of me. And I was going, who's that? And they're like, that's you. And I almost wanted to cry. I really did. I was like, oh my God, I'm big as a house. And that's when I had the choice in my life. What do I do? Do I go on a diet? Do I, because I knew them all by heart, do I fast again? Do I go on my cleansing? Or do I love it? And that's when I went on the journey of loving it. I started the Goddess Flesh Club. And again, the only requirement for joining was celebrate your cellulite. Or whatever it is that bothered you. I couldn't get anyone to join. But that didn't stop me. I went on this journey, and that was the beginning of the journey of loving myself. It was, you know, I read some books, and some of them said, take off all your clothes and stand in front of the mirror. Now, I wasn't ready for that. But here's some of the things that I did to love my fat. Fat, first of all, I had to say, what is fat? It's soft. It's nice, really. I mean, it's the last vestige of prejudice in our society. But really, if you take a look, it's really innocuous. It's soft. It's nice. And I wanted to love it. So what I would do is I would light some candles, put on some music, and this wasn't about masturbation, it was just about touching. Ooh, that's nice. Nice. Ooh. Not, you know, and just getting in touch with that fat and not seeing it as a negative thing, not seeing I gotta lose it or it's so bad or it doesn't look right or anything like that. And that's when I got into celebrating this body. And I have to say that when I started to celebrate my body, my attitude changed. And up until then, I could never get in a relationship. I couldn't get a relationship for the life of me, you know? I mean, I was hot, too, I have to say. I mean, when I say I was hot, people always turned their heads and looked at me. I mean, I was wearing spandex a lot, but high heels and totally made up. It's like if I walked down the street and they didn't look at me, I'd get up. If they did, what are you looking at? it was New York, you know, you had to do that. But, you know, here I am in my floral print, and then I also have this life-threatening bone marrow disease where I'm always hooked up to IVs, and I'm bruised all over, and I have this, you know, horrible modern-day pariah disease, HIV, and then I was diagnosed with AIDS. You know, I never lacked for a boyfriend. I could pick them up like that. Fat, disease, bald, didn't matter, you know, me. And because it was in my attitude. It was how I felt about me reflected how you felt about me. How I dealt with it was how you dealt with it. And the funny thing is, this is a really strange thing, but becoming heavier improved my sex life so incredibly. And actually getting HIV improved my sex life. So if you want to have a good sex life, just get infected. no one thinks that's funny at all. Except when I do it at conferences where everyone's HIV positive. Oh. But what do I mean by that? What I mean is that because I had to talk about it. You know, I had to talk about what was going on. I had to talk about how to be safe. I had to be intimate, and that's what it was. Not only did I learn to be intimate with myself and love myself, but I, even if it was a kind of a casual, you know, whatever, I still had to be intimate for that moment, and that made it a whole lot different. I went on this journey of loving my body, but something else happened in my life. That also took me to the place that I am now. I started to go out and speak and do a lot of speaking on HIV and AIDS. And one of the things that happens when you have a disease, you become so brave and courageous, you know? And you're not allowed any mistakes in life. You're really not. You're just supposed to be a victim. And what I found was I hated being a victim. And that's when I started to do the comedy, because I had to be more than just River Houston AIDS patient. And it was a really hard place to be, but I really wanted people to have a chance at their lives. And I wanted them to see that this was what HIV and AIDS looked like as well, but I didn't want to be a victim. And it was a hard balance to deal with. And I got angry. And I also, going through being ill all the time, I was ill, and I still deal with being ill all the time. One of the problems that I have is this bone marrow thing, where at this point in my life, I must have an IV every 6 days, and if I don't, I start to die. And about 3 years ago, the FDA pulled the treatment off the market that I was getting, and they thought it caused Mad-Cal disease, just in case you were wondering. And they pulled this off the market, and I started to die. And I was in the hospital for months on end. I was completely covered with bruises and bleeding in the eyes and bleeding all over. And I have to say that when I laid there dying, I didn't think once that I should lose some weight. And the funny thing is, I never got to wasting. my mother, who is obsessed about her body, I told her I had HIV, oh, well, now you can eat what you want. You'll get that wasting. I was like, Mom. My mother, I'll just talk a little bit about Mom, because she was such a huge influence in my life. My mother was from L.A. She wanted to be a starlet. She looked like one. I come from the family of tall and beautiful. I don't know what happened. I'm short and beautiful, but at the time I always thought I was not. And they enforced that. I remember when I was 6 years old and I said to my mom, I go, Mommy, am I pretty? And she was like, well, not really. But that's good, because you'll have to work on other things. And these are the truth. This was what I had to live with her. She also was so obsessed with her body and our bodies that she didn't feed us well. She had two meals that she served. She called them slop one and slop two. And she smoked at the kitchen table constantly. It was just not a healthy, nurturing atmosphere for loving your body and loving and accepting, because she so didn't accept herself. She hated aging. She told us that she was going to kill herself when she was 30, but she never told us how old she was, so every birthday we're like, her only holiday that we celebrated was Halloween, because she was a binger as well. She sent us out with the extra large hefty bags, and we'd come back, give them to me, We'd wake up in the morning, she'd be covered with wrappers and crumbs. And that's part of the place that I learned this. And even with the HIV, you'd be surprised how many women would say to me, well, you're going to lose weight. The funny thing is, I never lost weight with HIV. And when I was laying in the hospital, back to the hospital bed, and I thought that I was, they thought I was dying, and they were trying all different kinds of things, I found myself in a place of just rage. And it didn't have anything to do with the body stuff at all, really. I was just enraged at life. I was enraged at the doctors. I was enraged at everything that was going on around me. And I was mad at everybody, to the point that I didn't let anyone into that hospital room. Have you ever been mad at someone? Just even think right now. Have you ever been so angry at somebody that if you were stuck in a storm somewhere and you only had that one number, you would probably not call them? You'd walk 10 miles before you'd call them, and the whole way you'd be thinking of a nice public humiliation for them instead. And what I found was that I was so mad at so many people, starting with my family all the way to the doctors, that when I laid there dying, there was no one to be there with me. And I always expected my deathbed experience to be uplifting, but I was mad. And people would give me excuses. You could be a bitch, you're dying. But the thing about it was, I wasn't comfortable, I wasn't happy, and I didn't want to be there. And I told myself if I survived, I was going to change that. And I did. And I survived it, and I went on a journey of changing it. And that was the last piece in what I feel has given me the most wonderful life on this planet, and that was forgiveness. And one of the first places I needed to go was I needed to forgive myself. I didn't realize still, even though that I had loved and accepted my body, there was a piece of me that did not, I still held it against me that I was not everything I wanted to be. And it wasn't just the body image stuff, it had to do with everything. I wasn't a good enough writer. I'd written 4 books, and I'm always suspicious. I've gotten a lot of awards. I always said, I'll give it to the sick girl. But I needed to forgive myself for not being what I thought I needed to be. And then I needed to forgive everybody in my life, starting from childhood. I was Sweaty Betty, Wilma the Whale. I was a little chubby child growing up. We take those hurts, and we hold on to them, and we put them in our pocket. And don't we bring them up? My mother said this to me. In therapy, we go there. They called me this on the playground. And we hold on to that stuff. And I needed to let it go. I needed to cut it loose. I was raped when I was 14 by 6 men, beaten beyond recognition and thrown into a ditch naked. I was drinking that night. They had given me drugs. I didn't know they were drugs. I was basically kind of an outcast because of that incident. My school, everyone knew about it because it was so public, being dumped in this ditch, and everyone knew. And no one had sympathy because I'd been out. I had voluntarily gone with these guys and gone drinking. I had to forgive those men, and I had to forgive that community, and I had to forgive the therapist who definitely didn't help me in any way, shape, or form, because I carried all that stuff with me. All that was really the weight that I carried. And about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, after about a year after that incident in the hospital, I decided that, you know, I was working. I didn't know how to forgive. Forgiveness is a weird thing. It's not like me, Almighty, I forgive you. It wasn't about that. Forgiveness, I learned, was a state of mind. And I wanted to be in that state of mind in a way that kept me there all the time. So that when things happen, like road, someone cuts you off on the road, I don't even have to get mad anymore. It's just, I call it road love. Oh, he's saving me from getting a ticket, you know. Like if they're doing a speed limit or something in front of me. I'm on my way to yoga class. And so it was a state of mind, and I needed to cultivate that state of mind. About 8 months ago, I was fooling around. This treatment that I get it every week, and it's really painful, and it's really horrible, and it's similar to chemo that makes you feel very sick all the time. I was fooling around, like going 8 days, 9 days, just because I didn't feel like doing it. I've been doing it 3 years, every 6 days. And I went to a trip in Vermont, and I noticed a little bruise on my head, and I didn't really think anything of it, because I have little bruises everywhere. And when I came back, I was rushed to the emergency room, and they thought I was hemorrhaging from the brain, and they thought I was going to die that night. And that was about 8 months ago. And for, as you say, I made it. But I, the difference being that that night, it all fell into place for me. It was just this moment that I wish I could give to you without you having to go through it. I wish that you could get this, how precious life was, how much I did not want to die, how much it does not matter about the shape of my body, how much it does not matter, how much success I have. The most important thing in that moment, which was different from the other times, was that I was able to call people. They were able to come down to that hospital room, and they were able to hold me, and I was able to let them in. The most important thing in our lives is each other. We need each other desperately. We live in a world where we're inundated with images of all that we should be. We're should on all the time. We're told all the things that are irrelevant in a lot of ways, that have nothing to do with our realities. And we buy into it, and we forget about who we are and what we have to offer the world. The funny thing was, when I did put down the weight issue in, like, 92, that was when I started to be me. I became a poet. I mean, what did I have to lose? Before that, I would always stop myself. I'm not good enough, or it's not good, all these different things. But I didn't have to do that anymore. I could just go for it. And one of the reasons why I bring our little special guest here tonight, now you've all met him. Usually, you don't, he's like, okay, what? Usually when he comes out, no one knows that he's in the bag. So just imagine if you didn't know he was in the bag, what would you do? You'd go, right, good. See, he needs that. Can you do that a little louder for him? See, he loves that. He loves it. He lives for that, right? People all the time say things to me like, oh, I don't have any food. He doesn't care. What's he want? He wants this. He wants that. He wants love, right? When I go out into the world, Bud goes forth before me. And what follows, except for the dog haters, is this joy. Like all your faces, almost every single one of your faces is in this huge smile. And for a moment, you could love this dog. You don't care if he's on the table. You wouldn't care if there was food there. Let him on the table. It's like just you want to touch him, right? You just want to hold him. You like the little dog. And we can love this dog. And that's what I offer to you. Like when you look in the mirror, just imagine your little ears like that. Right, Bud? Going up and down. When Bud goes out into the world and he sees a woman in a mink coat, he never, like, goes up to her and spits on her and goes, bitch. He never does that. If he sees, like, a homeless person, he's like, yeah. You know, they're, like, on his level. They smell good, and they have food items. He never looks in the mirror. I never catch him like trying to look at his butt. Oh, I gotta lose a few ounces. He never does that. And all he wants is love, and it's all that we all want. It's what we all deserve. You know, when we go out into the world, I mean, wouldn't it be great? What's your name? Andrea. If Andrea walked in a room and we all went, wouldn't that be nice? But, you know, and we wouldn't smell your butt or anything. You know, stay away from that. We have boundaries. You know, I know sometimes when I'm flying, you know, like he'll be in the airport and there'll be just like all these people on the floor petting his belly, and I'm thinking, pet my belly. I just want my, I need my butt rubbed. But you know, we're not allowed to do that. I understand, but we are allowed to have the same amount of joy for life that he brings to the world. He's a therapy dog, and he actually goes into hospitals and rehabs and nursing homes, and he brings so much happiness. But I also bring him to the mall because those people really need happiness too. One of the funny things about the relationship with my mother, when I went through that forgiveness thing, she was one of the people I really needed to forgive. It was really, really hard to forgive her, though, because she, you know, she was a tough one. She was so highly critical of me. And one of the ways that I did my forgiveness, it was really interesting, was that I remember going to this conference. When I got this in my mind, I went to North Carolina, and they, or Duke University or something, for a week. And I met two girls there who were training for a marathon. And then on my way back, I picked up the running magazine because I got a little seed in my head. And they talked about that guy who did the Tour de France, Lance Armstrong. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. And I started to train for a marathon. And one of the things, for a whole year that I ran and trained for a marathon, and this is being pretty ill, but I just did it. I was very slow, you know. Like, when I was training, people with walkers would be going by, move it! It became my forgiveness runs. And 90% of that training, and I ran 4 to 6 miles every day, and on Sundays, I would get my IV Friday night, rest Saturday, and Sunday I did 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24, and 26 miles by myself running. I thought about how to forgive my mother. It was hard, and I would get so lost. And sometimes I'd imagine her as a small child and all the things she went through. And I did interview my grandmother to understand her life better. And then I decided, after I thought I was certain I had forgiven her, then you have to test it. So I was going through Seattle, and it was pouring rain, and she lives in the Northwest, so I had her meet me in Seattle in the rain in a hotel room for 3 days. I drove when we left the room at all times. I don't know if you have a, you know, like that kind of. When I told my mother I did lectures on body image, she go, "Oh, well, you tell fat people it's okay to be fat. That's not healthy." that's my mom. You know, we went to the dessert. We went to a restaurant where there was a dessert bar, and she's like, "Go get me more." She's like setting me up, like her. I became so enamored with my mother because I was able to go beyond. I didn't take it personal anymore. When I forgave, I removed all the buttons that she could push. And I just saw her as this amazing woman. And when she does get a little hard on me, because I have to just tell you a little thing she did to me the other day that was so terrible. I always think it's great material because I do stand-up comedy. So I always say, when my mother gets too much for me, I always go, "Mom, you're giving me way too much material." You know. But actually, I'm not going to tell that story because it was so awful. But anyway, I love my mother. I take her in small doses. I try and see her as a child of God. And if you have the problem with the God thing, just put an extra O in there. It's the goodness in the world, and she's a part of that. And do you like me? Sort of? You think I'm doing a good job? I'm my mother's daughter. She had some part in it, you know? She gave birth. That's what I look at. I do a lot of good in the world, and she has to have some part in that. So I do, I forgive her, and I love her. She's on the West Coast. I'm here, and that's kind of good. But I definitely get excited to see her now more than dreading. Anyone here, you know, when you know that your mother's coming, you just dread it. You just like, it's like awful. Now I actually get excited. I think it's going to be a fun thing. I know I definitely have more material. One of the things that I work with mainly when it comes with food disorders, like I put out, there's a questionnaire out on that table, and you can look at that. I don't work with people with extreme food disorders, like though I have lots of information to help people, but I work with people who have an unhealthy relationship with their body and food. And also I work a lot with women who are HIV positive or who have cancer especially women going through, because both those diseases are, can be very disfiguring. And it's very traumatic. One of the side effects to the new drugs around HIV and AIDS, it takes all the fat out of your arms and your butt and your arms, your butt, and your face. And it displaces onto your belly, so you look like a barrel with stick legs. Your face collapses. It's really hard because it's just hard to look at. I went to a conference where there were 1,000 HIV-positive women, and 90% of them had this terrible look. And you also get a hump on your back. It's really rough, and I work a lot with them on how to still be a sex goddess because, again, it comes from within. And I have to say that I trained for that marathon, and I ran that whole marathon and everything. I still didn't lose weight. I was running at about almost like 190 pounds, and I'm 5 feet tall. When I finished that marathon, and I had truly believed that I had forgiven everyone, weight left my body, and it was not about dieting, and I'm not here to advocate losing weight in any way, shape, or form, but that's when I realized that weight had nothing to do with fat. It was all the weight that I carried.
Remarks from River Houston, an advocate for women health issues. She spoke on the topic, how women feel about their bodies. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.